Hey everybody, I'm Aaron.
I'm Dee, and combined, we're the Wonder Twins. For deliciously geeky fun
and mega nerdy hygiene,
follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
Weekly episodes can be found on YouTube, SoundCloud, iTunes, and Google Play. We're the best little podcast in Texas, Joe.
We're the Wonder Twin Powers Activate Show.
Gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. I am Andrew Farmer, and with me, as always, the Jedi Cole Houston.
I am here indeed, and we are really excited for a variety of reasons today.
A variety of reasons. First of all, PJ Dunn's with us tonight.
Yeah, the Vega Bomber. Yes. Welcome, sir.
The Vega Bomber. Boom. Blast. Everything has to blow up. We got to drop truth bombs and all kinds of bombs. Here we go.
So, we're going to be dropping bombs tonight.
That is, I want
like
to
bring up.
That's prophetic, that, yeah. PJ. That's prophetic. Because
I just want to say that you are now the Vega Pumpkin Bomber.
That's exactly it.
Tonight we talk about a man driven to madness by a secret formula that was tampered with by his family. We talk about a man driven to put on a costume, own a corporation, hell bent on creating secret evil enterprises while on the surface providing for the general welfare of society. Tonight, of course, we talk about Orville Redenbacher. Orville Redenbacher constantly seeks the secret of the perfect layered butter. I don't trust kettle corn, and I don't trust Orville Redenbacher. No. Of course, we're
Redenbacher was famous for in his villainous career that a lot of people don't know about because the snack industry has covered it up, but he would fly around in a giant movie popcorn container hurling flaming popcorn balls.
Just aerodynamically shit. It was not okay. Yeah. It doesn't work. By the way, when he flipped the script, he was known as Orville Redenbacher.
Oh
yeah, it's gonna be that kind of show tonight, ladies. Yeah.
It's coming. He's already got the future design for the new vapor pumpkin bombs.
Oh wow! Well, that's because a lot of places you can't use your smoking pumpkin bombs anymore.
Right.
That's
so
right.
A lot of people are switching to vaping.
Right.
So he's ordinance correct now.
That's right.
He's within city ordinances for New York. Tonight we talk about the Green Goblin, focusing primarily on Norman, maybe getting into his lineage a little bit. But, Cole, what are we doing here?
We are doing, right now, this is the 267th episode or issue of this show. We are just pushing that 300 mark, and this is Roguish Eyes 2. If you're not familiar, we did about a year or so ago, I think. I really seriously lose track of these things, but we did an episode or an issue, an arc called Roguish Eyes, where we talked about the Batman Rogues Gallery in depth, five distinct characters that have been thorns in Batman's side. And granted, we couldn't touch on everybody. We're not going to do it with this one. But this is Roguish Eyes 2, Tangled Web. And, of course, we are talking about none other than the pantheon of villains that have plagued Alpha Flight since their inception. Gilded Lily, Pink Pearl, The Master.
Of course, Stilt Man.
no one knew why Stiltman went to Canada. He just kind of accidentally stepped over the border. It's got a lot of, when you have a 75-foot gate, there's that as well. No, seriously, though, we are here to talk about the villains of Spider-Man, which are some of the most iconic and popular villains in comic history. Mm. And beg the question, why haven't we got to this before? Because we had to do Batman first. Shut up.
Because Batman threatened us.
That's right. Yes. He said, I'm going to make you a fourth meal. Fourth meal called a Batarang.
Yeah, we had to do DC first because Marvel's already got such a big lead in the other departments like the Cinematic Universe.
That's right. When in doubt, if you can be Batman, be Batman. If you can talk about Batman, talk about Batman.
Right.
The Batmans.
If you listen to the first Roguish Eyes story arc, and if you haven't, I suggest going back and listening to it, you'll know that we've did extensive deep dive research into the histories and the creations of these characters. Now, what's really interesting about the Green Goblin is, and Norman Osborn in particular, is that on the creation of Norman Osborn, we don't have a lot to go on. Ditko and Lee were pretty tight-lipped about where he came from. Now, there is a lot of really interesting kind of mythology and conspiracy around some of the major plot points with Norman Osborn. We get interviews with Ditko and Lee about some of that stuff. But about the actual creation, we're kind of going to have to go historically and literarily on this. So just a little bit of backstory. Spider-Man 14 was the inception of the Green Goblin. That was 1964. And this is back when
Green Goblin's a year older than I am.
Wow.
So at 53 years old, he's had a remarkable run in comics. And it's interesting to point out that in his first appearance, he flew around on the Dyson witch's broom.
Yeah, he absolutely did.
Because I've taken the traditional witch's broom and improved it.
That was pretty good. That was a pretty good impression. Yes. No, but I think if we're going to deep dive on this, right, I think that we have to look at Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde, guys. I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You had included that amongst your research, and it's one of those really compelling stories that is, good Lord, like 100 years old, and still is the inspiration or the catalyst for so many characters, because the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is it's kind of a timeless tale.
It is, and I think the really interesting thing about Norman Osborn is that when we talk about a Jekyll and Hyde character now, we talk about a character that is, for lack of a better term, unpredictable. Oh, he's such a Jekyll and Hyde. Or Incredible Hulk is often referenced as a Jekyll and Hyde type character. The problem I have with that is, classically, the closest to a Jekyll and Hyde character is absolutely the Green Goblin. Because the secret nine herbs and spices that make you the Green Goblin also make you insane and bloodthirsty and evil, versus the man who was not. He might have been a bad dad. He might have been a bit of a dick, but he wasn't an evil genius mastermind until after he took it. So it's the closest historically, I think, to the Jekyll and Hyde story.
Absolutely. And you have a Jekyll and Hyde that's a little bit more grounded than, say, your Hulk Jekyll and Hyde, which there you're getting into, much higher concepts like bending the possibilities of physics and what have you.
Sure. Did we lose PJ?
I think so.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out where you got off to here. I'm on the wrong side here for contacts. PJ, there he is. Add to group call. We're going to try this again. This is odd. What's odd is he called me via Skype, and I just sort of added him to this call.
Right. Well, do you want to keep going and see if he can rejoin?
Yeah, let me drop him a line here real quick and see if he can... Okay, there we go. And what's interesting also, when I was looking over some of the history of Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde, there was actually a quote from the author's stepson, who ironically, his name was Lloyd Osborne.
Was it really?
Yes.
Oh, see, we got
what
there.
What are the chances? We got
there. I was feeling bad because I couldn't find much on the creation of, on the actual, like, inspiration for the character, but way to go, Cole. You got us there.
For who knows if that was part of it. What's really fascinating is the style in which Stan Lee wrote, in which he collaborated with his co-creators. Especially, I've heard him talk about a lot of the monster comics that he did with Jack Kirby.
Right.
And he would say, you know, I would just kind of come in and say here's a name like Goon, and then Jack would draw some crazy character. And I think that may be why we don't see a lot of that is I get the impression from what I've seen with Stan Lee talking about how he created a lot of his characters, it was very stream of consciousness.
Well, so here's the way Stan pitched this, by the way. So that you know, here's the quote, okay, from Ditko. You know, somebody made Ditko come out of his apartment long enough to give a quote. Stan's synopsis for The Green Goblin had a movie crew on location finding an Egyptian-like sarcophagus. Inside was an ancient mythological demon, the Green Goblin. He came to life, and he came to life. I changed Stan's mythological demon to a human villain. It seems like the Green Goblin is an extremely contentious character in a contentious relationship. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And knowing that Stan had this idea of, I don't know, it almost sounds like something out of the monster comics themselves in a way.
Of course.
You know, you could always just recycle that and tell Jack, we'll call it Moomin. And, boom, there you go. There's a story. But it's kind of a curious thought that far into the series. They're well over a year in, almost a year and a half in.
Right.
And to start trying to introduce something so outside of the, I guess you'd call it more science fiction-based characters. Well, everybody in the Rogues Gallery up to that point was sort of like super science and...
Well, I think that was important at the time, and I think that, yeah, and we talked about when that changed from the magic to the science in the 60s in a previous show, but I there's some other quotes here that I wanted to get to, and I want to give a huge shout out. Someone out there, and I need to find out who it is and get them on the show, did a website called thegreengoblinshideout.com, and this person did the Lord's work. Has it broken down into 17 chapters of Norman of the Green Goblin's history with citing sources and comic panels and just the whole thing. It's this guy loves the Green Goblin. So we need to find this guy and get him on the show. And if nothing else, I just wanted to give him huge props for putting this thing together.
Oh, absolutely. That's pretty impressive.
It's really impressive, but so a lot of our research came from that source. There was, I guess, another disagreement as to whether or not to make the Green Goblin somebody that you've seen in the comic or just somebody that you don't know. You know, don't have him be Harry Osborn. And Ditko thought it would cheat the readers if it wasn't somebody they'd met already.
Exactly.
Which is how it ended up being Harry Osborn. Which is Norman Osborn, Harry's later, which is how it ended up being Norman Osborn, which is pretty amazing. I think that's really cool. They revealed it later that it was Norman Osborn.
Well, it's also kind of a unique thing for its time, where you're having that kind of turn, where you have this character that's been just sort of supporting cast becoming a major player.
Right. And it was brilliant. It's a mystery novel at that point. You know, what is also a mystery is, and you and I talked about this offline, and I think we did so vitriolically and quite loud, because I know you've done some research into this. It's what, I don't know whether it was the Goblin Serum that did this, or just maybe the G book was left out of Norman's Encyclopedia Britannica, that the delivery man hadn't come to the house with the G's yet. But his general idea of what a goblin is and does so far afield from any historical or mythological backing, it's amazing to me.
Yeah, I started looking into, you know, the idea of the goblin in folklore as you know, being this kind of mischievous being. And by the way, the reason you haven't heard PJ is his phone was overheating, so we lost him for a little while there.
He's going to attempt to come back to us.
Yeah, we're trying to get him back. Have you returned
you
to us?
No, there he is.
PJ has returned to us. We were just explaining why you had been so uncharacteristically silent during all.
So,
yeah, yes. Yeah.
Welcome back. We discussed a little bit about some sort of connections to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, whether by accident or design, and the irony that Stevenson, the author, his stepson was his stepson's last name was Osborne.
Which is great.
Spelled in a very British way, but still, Osborne, nonetheless. How wonderful that. And we're getting into the idea of Norman Osborn taking a serum that drives him mad and augments his abilities and apparently gives him a very curious outlook on what constitutes a goblin.
Well, you know, when I used to see him, I used to think more of like Medusa's face.
Oh, nice.
That's what I used to think of, and then I guess he has the coolest European man bag than any villain ever, right?
I'm telling you, the Purse of Doom is an accessory, a fashion statement, unprecedented in comics.
So my thing is, the first stage is, you take this serum that apparently was an attempt, because they just couldn't stop. They just couldn't stop trying to replicate a super soldier serum. It was like trying to make what was the name of that, PJ, you might remember, what was the name of that movie with I think it was Val Kilmer, and it was the Cold Fusion movie, or everybody's trying to invent cold fusion and he's a spy, and
yes, oh man, you would mention that one too. Yeah, Val Kilmer's the best clue on that one.
But it's like that movie where apparently there's an arms race to create the super soldier serum. So Oscorp is trying to make the super soldier serum. He has a disgruntled employee who just screws with it. Like, that's all he does is screws with the serum. I'll show you. And then it made him go insane. And the first thing you do, of course, when you take an insane-making serum is try to start finding a costume that strikes fear into the hearts of men.
That's right.
And that's a green and purple jester's costume, apparently.
Yeah, it's like he raided the Renaissance Fair and the set of Land of the Lost. Because he's got like a secondhand Sleestak costume, and he's wearing a tunic and high boots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a nightcap that puts Ebenezer Scrooge to shame.
Yeah, what's up with this purple thing? So you've got the purple man, the Joker's wearing purple, the Riddler wears purple and green. So everybody's got this purple thing with green. What's up with that?
There actually is a color theory there. And I think, Cole, didn't we do something on the color theory a little bit?
We may have talked a bit about that, but we cover so much ground on and off the show. But what's fascinating is, speaking to the costume and that, you know, impractically long hat. And I think we were talking a couple of days ago about how the well, we'll get to that in a minute when we talk about his sweet ride. But what's fascinating, when I was researching goblins, of course, one of the places you wind up going in this day and age is Wikipedia. And the illustration for goblin is apparently a 19th century illustration. And it's this fuzzy little impish creature wearing a kind of hoodie cloak that the headpiece is actually pointy.
Yeah, yeah. Ettins and red caps, and they all had like pointy hats, but they didn't.
So I guess there is, but yeah, they weren't necessarily, you know, they didn't walk off the set of Gargoyles.
Well, they didn't walk
with Bernie Casey,
colorblind Gwildor over there.
Or the dark elves, right? The dark elves in the Norse mythology with Thor.
That's
they got the
closer.
pointy ears.
Yeah. But I guess, you know, it all comes down sometimes to alliteration, and Green Goblin,
I guess,
is
worth Stan.
Yeah. Well, it is, the name itself is a very Stanley character name. You can just see him kind of, Steve, I've got it. The Green Goblin. And he's Egyptian. It's like,
right.
They
right.
didn't have yeah. goblins in ancient Egypt. It's largely European kind of concept. But yeah, you mentioned like the red cap, which was a goblin that dyed its a hat in human blood.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
But the goblins and hobgoblins were traditionally trickster mythological characters. For the yes. most part, they were, one of the things they liked to do was lure especially children away and trick them. And but also to just anywhere from mischievous to just downright evil.
Mm.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
Kind of like monkeys with a bigger brain, all the way up to just like evil monkeys with a bigger brain.
But to take this uh-huh. one step further, choosing the goblin persona, right?
Okay.
So you've yeah. chosen it now. I will mm-hmm. allow the costume. I will say, okay. It was the 60s. Lord knows what was going on. You can have the costume. Then to say, you know what? What are goblins known for? Oh, that's right. Flying on broomsticks, pumpkins, and carrying little satchels. Let's do all of that, too.
Yeah. Let's, well, you know, the thing is, what part of the super soldier serum that you've created, albeit it has driven you insane, but at what point do you make that leap to suddenly go and get like a full body life cast so you can get a custom rubber suit made?
Right.
And,
right. And who does that
and the,
for
and the,
you?
And the costuming. I mean, Norman Osborn isn't the kind of guy who, like, you know, was wardrobe in college Shakespeare in the Park productions. Where do you get those great purple Elfie boots? But again, it was the 60s, so, I mean, maybe he just went to Woodstock.
Yeah.
I'll trade you this brown acid
for your purple boots.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe there was, Wizard of Oz was coming through, and so they decided to go get some of those lollipop Lilliputian people's costumes and kind of mix it, you know, kind of throw it together, you know.
But
I think as an industrialist, he probably did a lot of work with universities, so he probably just snuck into the costuming in the theater department while he was on campus.
But here's the thing. We can talk about this and we joke, right?
Right.
We joke about the character. We joke about the concept and what he uses. For the time, in 64, this was a very dark character.
Oh, good night, yes.
This was one of the strangely very, very dark characters in comics. From the secret identity villain to, mm-hmm. you know, the insanity to losing his memory, having that full Jekyll and Hyde experience where if he learned that Peter Parker was Spider-Man as the Green Goblin, when he awoke as Norman Osborn, he could not remember it. Like, there's a lot of really weird,
That's right.
angles to this character.
And I think in many ways the costume becomes the man and the man the costume. It is a lot like we've talked often about how Batman and Bruce Wayne are two separate entities and that Batman is the superior.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we see that as well in Osborne, that the costume is literally, when he puts on the costume, he's also putting on the goblin. The goblin demands its own skin. And that's why you have this unique, especially for the time with Spider-Man's villains, here's a character who doesn't just put on a costume so he's dressed up like the superheroes or vice versa. He is putting on a full body, head to toe, uncomfortable rubber mask with a giant hat. It's probably 300 degrees inside that thing. But the man who was during the time of the Goblin was Osborn is no more. And in that strange way that some psychoses take people outside of themselves, I think that, you know, whether it was intentional, and it probably wasn't, you can sort of extrapolate and build upon these characters. And Green Goblin is the costume.
Yeah.
And that's why you need all of those very curious and awkward elements, because that's where the Green Goblin lives, is inside the suit.
Yes, I would agree with that.
And do you think that maybe that's what also, as they progress to say, well, why don't we just create a symbiote then, and then do Venom and Carnage based off of that same premise, but, you know, starting with Green Goblin?
Ooh. Yeah, I had never really thought of it that way.
But really, that's interesting, PJ.
That's a great observation, is that in many ways, even though the symbiote is its own independent entity, it then begins to act a lot like this goblin. And I think it's borne out in some of the scenes you see in the comics, prior to any kind of retrofitting.
Yeah.
Or even in some of the early comics, you see the struggle between Osborn and the goblin itself.
Right, you absolutely do. He doesn't, it's that, you know, again, it's that Jekyll and Hyde thing where he doesn't want, he doesn't, that hearken to the Incredible Hulk, you know, Norman isn't here right now type scenario. But before we get real dark, Cole, why don't you talk a little bit about his major means of conveyance?
Yes, indeed, the Goblin Glider. Once he shed the Harry Potter 9000, I didn't even know what Harry Potter was back then. The author wasn't even born yet. But the Goblin Glider is one of the most wonderful, iconic comic book vehicles, in that it rests within that wonderful Hall of Fame for comic book vehicles by being completely impossible.
Yeah.
There's nothing at all. I mean, the Witchy Poo is one thing, but, you know, and which very much is like Witchy Poo's own mega broom. But to take it a step further, and I think what you're seeing with the Green Goblin is with the broom, with the pumpkins, the jack-o'-lantern bombs, with the Goblin Glider, in a way it is invoking the masquerade, invoking folklore, invoking the very European mythology of the goblin, and Halloween, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's branding. You
know, yeah, it was literally, and so what else goes with these gothic concepts of the night, like a bat? So you go from the broom to this savage metal bat thing.
Like you said, the least aerodynamic possible means of conveyance. It's, what did you refer to it as? A jet engine attached to one of those.
It's like a rocket attached to one of those balance boards that people, you know, use to practice their surfing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or a boogie board.
Yeah.
with giant metal horns on the front, which never come back to haunt you.
Precisely. And no, that would never be a bad idea.
The hood ornament for it.
That's right.
And it's all controlled entirely by your feet, which are in giant pixie boots.
Yeah, it's like a special harness made for that.
It's like a clown married a pixie, and they had to, you know, this was the footwear for their offspring.
Well, it's like an anorexic Etrogen the Demon.
Same costume. Sort of fashion sense there. And then you factor in the, I was speculating, we were talking about how decidedly un-aerodynamic this thing is. And how the first thing it does is basically dislocate your legs as it drags you bodily to your death by smashing into the nearest solid object after the booster rockets kick in, is the ears of the goblin costume, which were abnormally, unnecessarily large, would actually act as sort of a tiller. It's like the rudder. It's the crest of a pteranodon. It just to help you try desperately to steer.
Yeah, how do you? I mean, he makes like hairpin turns in that thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. How does an industrialist have like skateboarding skills? You know, like snowboarding skills, right?
Yeah. It was obvious he didn't spend a lot of time doing outdoor recreation prior to this. And perhaps it's one of those weird things that, you know, you can get away with in comics where literally it's like, what was the Shyamalan film?
Which one?
With the multiple personalities.
Split?
Split. That was, I called Split. It Switch last night, but that's Alan Barkin and Jimmy Smits. but like in Split, that literally there's like, maybe he had all this untapped potential as a extreme sports star that it took becoming an insane, murderous Halloween character with a silver shamrock mask.
Yeah.
Anybody?
Yeah.
That's
my favorite Halloween movie.
Exactly. Silver shamrock. So, yeah, it's one of those things. The suspension of disbelief is a given in comics, that there's always something for your web to catch on to in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
There's just apparently no shortage of nooks, crannies, gargoyles, lampposts, no matter what altitude.
Yeah, that's true. So
if you're willing to buy Spider-Man, it's like, you know, getting one of those
obligated
breakfast cereals with the bank shrink wrap to it.
Mm-hmm.
You're buying both.
Go ahead, PJ.
I was just going to say, it seems like, since you mentioned that makes sense, and especially being in New York, you would think that maybe the villain you might create, if you're going to create something like that, would be a gargoyle, since they're already there, and all you have to do is have some kind of weird space meteor hit one of the buildings, hit one of the gargoyles, and boom, it's alive, and now you don't have to explain all that stuff. Except for that he becomes an industrial, you know, giant later. But at least the gargoyles, you know, you would make sense.
Well, maybe the gargoyle had been sitting there so long and thinking and listening that he had some mad skills that were just untapped in his...
It's a Rockefeller-style gargoyle.
Yeah. Rockefeller.
God, I can't do this with you. Sad. No, but so I want to talk a little bit about turning it back to just how dark this character is. Amazing Spider-Man 121 and 122, and we're just going to jump right into it. The first lasting, if you went and saw Infinity Wars and you thought that was shocking,
mm-hmm.
imagine it being what 19 I think it's 1966, 67.
Yes.
And reading the death of Gwen Stacy.
Well, yes. The fact that there were no punches pulled. None. I wonder what this issue is called. The death of Gwen. The hell?
Well, and
it couldn't be like, you know, somebody's going to die. But no, it's like, boom, you know that Gwen Stacy is going to live to the end of this episode, this particular issue.
Right. And then Norman Osborn figures out who Gwen Stacy is, and we are not talking about the retcon where she's not dead and had a child with Norman Osborn. We will never talk about it. We've made it 260 some issues. We're not doing it now.
That's I guess the first time it's even been brought up.
Yeah, I don't want to. I never want to talk about it. You know, kidnaps her to lure in Spider-Man and takes her to the top of, I forget what bridge it is. Do you remember what bridge it is?
Was it the Brooklyn Bridge?
It might have been Brooklyn.
I think it might have been, I think.
You know, takes her to the top of the Brooklyn Bridge. You know, basically.
Oh, the George Washington Bridge. I'm going to save face here. It was the George Washington Bridge.
Okay.
Okay.
And kills Gwen Stacy. Kills her. And I think that might have been the first major kind of woman in the fridge, girlfriend in the fridge experience in comics up to that point. At that scale, at that level, with that much weight.
It was very highly impactive because you go into the book, the cover is Spider-Man confronted by these portrait images of pretty much all his entire supporting cast.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he is basically crying out to the reader that his spider sense is telling him someone close to him is going to die. And it, you know, it's never wrong, but who is going to die? And, you know, here's Norman and Harry Osborn, Gwen Stacy, Mary Jane, Robbie, Aunt May, I think that's Glory Grant, and I'm not sure who, Flash Thompson.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some there, it's like, who's going to die? And hopefully it will be a couple of these people that I wouldn't miss. But, you know, Peter's too good to say that.
For a point of reference, Cole, I just sent over the image of her death. And this is the way it was portrayed in a comic book in the 60s.
Yes.
Literally, her neck snapped, lolling to the side.
Ugh.
Like, insane. Like,
it is Spidey trying to save her, and ultimately, this was like one of those unprecedented times where sometimes heroes fail.
Right.
That was the action of trying to save her. Was her death the more humane as a result? Because either way, it was this impossible gambit that is presented to the reader in this story that if you really analyze it, Gwen Stacy's death was preordained. She was going to die. There was no way she could survive the fall.
Right.
And basically what you get in the context of her death is the blame shifts in entirely the wrong way from the Green Goblin, who is the author of her death, to Spider-Man, who carries guilt like an albatross.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he just added another 40-pound albatross to his neck.
Well, the, and this
like,
book,
like, let me move you over, Uncle Ben. I've got to add Gwen to the weight upon my shoulders. Because in many ways, this is the Green Goblin's most insidious action.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because he should have been the focus of Peter's rage and hatred, and instead he turns that antagonism into self-loathing.
Oh, absolutely.
And Green Goblin is like flying away scot-free on his little impossible sky rider there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and this marks, widely recognized by comics historians as marking the end. This comic ended the Silver Age of comics and took you into the Bronze Age, which was, we were starting to get into the 70s and 80s, you know, dark ages of comics where everything had to be grittier and Frank Miller and, you know, and well, you started getting the Punisher and...
It's interesting you invoke Frank Miller because a lot of times he's sort of the go-to, the hot button.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Recognizable name. But that dismisses things like Speedy living up to his name and getting hooked on speed.
Yeah.
It dismisses Harry Osborn getting all doped, hopped up on goofballs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of dark crap that was happening before Miller came on the scene.
That's true. That's true.
And before Moore came on the scene. And in many ways, these are the things that I feel inform those writers.
Sure,
who take that,
that makes sense.
A step further, because, you know, Speedy goes on drugs, and then, you know, a handful of years later, he's just goofing off with those crazy kids over the Teen Titans who were rated all the way up to number two. You
know? But, you know, that makes sense that that would happen, because if you look at it in the 60s, you had the Civil Rights Movement and all that going on. So you had America in turmoil, plus the whole Vietnam thing and everything else that was going on top of it. So you had a lot of people with a lot of angst, you know, trying to figure out what's this all about? What does this mean? Because I think there's also that comic with Green Lantern and Green Arrow where they, you know.
Oh, absolutely. The Hard Traveling Heroes story arc where
our favorite
they are confronted with a lot of harsh realities.
Yes. Yes. And so you see that kind of going on. Seem to be kind of like a part and parcel of the 60s, right, which would then eventually prove all the stuff that we'd end up seeing in the 70s and then the goofiness and the wackiness of the 80s, right?
Yeah, in many ways, it just sort of like there was this turning point, let's like get back to basics, let's tell fun stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of comic readers were growing up. The proliferation of comics was increasing, especially by the 80s and into the 90s. And, you know, we could go on for days and have about what all happened in that period. And what's fascinating in that very context, here you have this character who is perhaps the most iconic Spider-Man villain. Little wonder he was chosen to launch the franchise as the ideal starting off character for Spider-Man to go up against. And you get the evolution of comics happening concurrently. And somehow what's wonderful about the most iconic characters is they have survived.
Yeah.
Vastly yeah. changing landscape of comic readership and write and authorship.
Yes.
And even the editorial stewardship of the publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And well, these guys just keep coming and coming and coming.
One of the other things I wanted to talk about was outside of the Goblin persona, right? Osborn became sort of, I guess, a mirror image to what was going on in the political landscape after the events of Dark Reign and Siege, where he took over S.H.I.E.L.D. and renamed it Hammer.
Oh, yes.
And created the Dark Avengers. He took the Iron Man armor and painted it as the Iron Patriot and played upon the fears and the xenophobia after, you know, Asgard crash landed into Earth and all of that and you know, took a bunch of villains and made them Avengers kind of to do his will. And you know, you had Daken as Wolverine and Venom as Spider-Man and the robot Thor as mm-hmm. you know as Thor and it really shows you the mad genius of the character. And the only reason he fell off is because the Goblin managed, as he would get more stressed out and more angry, the Goblin would take more control, and eventually the Goblin screwed everything up for him. But this was straight Osborn. You know, was straight Osborn being a monster. So
yeah, and I think you see Osborn as the sort of captain of industry also evolving with the times and becoming more and more insular and very much just looking out for numero uno.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it plays very well that the Goblin is ultimately a deeper part of his actual existing psyche. And then it becomes very Nietzschean gazing into the abyss.
Yeah.
Because it's like that wonderful, to my way of thinking, nobody ever wrote the Demon Etrigan as well as Alan Moore.
Right.
Or as Michael Moore for that matter. Bowling for Demons. Great movie. There was a wonderful scene in a Swamp Thing that Moore wrote where Abigail Arcane is having a discussion with Jason Blood about Etrigan. And Blood explains that he and Etrigan came to an agreement and basically warns never make a deal with a demon because, you know, it's one of these house always wins kind of thing. And their deal was they would become more like each other. And each kept up their end of the bargain. Jason Blood becomes more bellicose and ill-tempered. And Etrigan becomes more like Jason Blood, becoming more like Etrigan.
Right. They feed so, off each other.
So, the dilution of Etrigan is not nearly as extreme as the augmentation in the wrong direction of Jason Blood. So, and I think that you see a similar sort of dynamic without that sort of twisted pact, in that the longer the goblin is a part of Osborn's life, the more like the goblin Osborn's own personality becomes.
Sure.
Because it is the alpha personality.
We should talk a little bit about the movies, shouldn't we? We should talk a little
Absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely. I think so.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
I think so.
We should also, just very briefly, because I have minimal exposure and experience with the Ultimates universe.
Yeah.
But it's almost like the Goblin goes full circle to my way of thinking, because is not the Green Goblin in the Ultimates universe some sort of actual supernatural
being? Giant weird goblin-y monster thing.
But it's like it's Stan Lee's Egyptian demon.
You're right.
Yeah.
The character came full circle and no one noticed.
Yeah. Wow.
You're like, screw you, Ditko. But I just had to bring that up very briefly because I had never had any desire to delve into the Ultimates, but
no, you're absolutely correct. You are absolutely correct.
It always struck me odd that, you know, that was the direction they took as part of a vast departure in that particular character, where it wasn't just like, oh, here's our new take on it. It's like, well, this is an entirely different take on the character. And I didn't realize that there was a potential connection there to the original stated origin.
Yeah, there you are. Oh man! All right, so movies. Let's wrap this up by talking about Green Goblin in the movies. Made one movie appearance. No, I guess he made two, didn't he?
Sort of.
The Garfield and
actually
and
made
the what was it? The
sense. Because they had that sort of half-ass Green Goblin with the paintball mask.
Yeah.
Hey now.
Yeah.
Hey now. It didn't start as a paintball mask. It started as one of my favorite actors of all time playing the Green Goblin, which is
Willem
very
Dafoe.
Exciting for me. That being Willem Dafoe.
No, I was going to say two and a half words. Willem Dafoe.
There was a firefight. Sorry, that was Boondock Saints reference.
I'm surprised you didn't go like all was it Streets of Fire?
Oh, anything. Any Willem Dafoe.
Yeah.
I think he did a great job with this. I really do.
Yes, he did.
I think that
what you get with Dafoe is this incredible range where you've got like Norman at Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And he's just like all like, you know, kind of playful and flirty and having a good time. He's like there with his son and his son's best friend. And it's, you know, he's like going and seeing how the other half celebrate Thanksgiving. And you also have the troubles with his company, trying to keep this company going with lucrative government contracts with a government that's demanding more and more and better and better and bigger than, you know, he's overstepped himself and you see that. And then you see the goblin persona and you just get this wonderful spectrum out of this actor.
Well, yes. He has the range to pull something like that off. It's not easy.
Hell yes.
You know, I don't know. It was, I thought it was great. I loved it. I thought, you know, at the time, they went more all in for 2002 than a lot of movies were going with superhero movies.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, and I think most of that had to do with the CGI had gotten better at that point. So by the time you get to the Spider-Man and the Raimi Spider-Mans, you could do it because Matrix proved and the prequels had proved that, hey, it's gotten better now, so we can actually make a guy crawl on a wall and not look so cheesy or look like the 60s Batman where they're kind of going up the side of the building with a rope. They had that kind of figured out.
It's funny you mention that because at the point where Spider-Man was forthcoming, we were starting to see some stuff, I had literally started to voice that film has caught up to the superhero.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it truly had. That was literally the point where you're starting, everything was going to be possible going forward.
Yes. And you're right.
You can't do.
That's exactly right. And to your point about the performance, Andrew, Willem Dafoe, I mean, if you think about it, everybody talks about how there's a villain problem Marvel, but if they go back and see this one, you're right, because the anguish that he has, that he displays on his face, and Willem Dafoe just has that kind of face that when he's looking at himself in the mirror and when he flaps, his eyes get crazy, you really get scared for a moment. Like, so the menace is there from the comics of the 60s, which was what Cole was talking about earlier, that you see that menace that was written into the comics. Well, you see it embodied by Willem Dafoe's face. Like, when he did that, it looked in the mirror and then all of a sudden he flashed. And he was talking evil, and his face looked evil, and that was no CGI. That's just the way that man's face can twerk and look. Mm-hmm. And he looked, like, menacing. And I think some of the scenes where Spider-Man's coming there, being your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, to try to save somebody, like when he's in that burning building, and he thinks it's a woman he's going to save, and he turns around real fast, and it's a goblin. I mean, like, there was terror, a little bit of fear, a little bit of almost like horror movie-ish type of gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a superhero movie.
No, but you're absolutely right.
What's wonderful is you see just the tiniest – talk about the flash of – you get this hint of the goblin in what I call hashtag Tandy Slap.
Yeah.
Where he gets smacked for trying to steal some marshmallow off the top of the yams.
Yeah.
And yes. You get this moment where it's – there's indignation written heavily.
Yeah.
It's not just, oh, hey, you little bitch, you slapped me. It's like – you know, how dare you touch the great green goblin? Oh, I'm not supposed to say
I'm
that.
Not him. I'm not him right now. Yeah.
I mean, if I was green goblin, you wouldn't slap him, would you? I'll show you. I'm going to bust down your bedroom wall later, and you little minx you, a little something else. I bet Doc Ock would like to give you a little. Oh, anyway. getting ahead of myself with the comics. And...
Yeah, but then they missed. I really. So the kid that played the goblin in. Amazing Garfield Spider-Man, the Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
Yes.
They really missed the mark.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I feel like they really missed the mark there. The kid isn't a bad actor.
No, in fact, what they gave him, he did very well with.
I mean, if you've seen Valerian, you know the kid can act. And you know the kid can act against Green. But Chronicle, for that matter.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this just it's like they turned a blind eye from what made – it's like they decided that the Raimi films were such a quote-unquote failure even though they weren't. Like, they made a lot of money. People went and saw those movies.
That's right.
Those were fun, good – I mean, that's why, you know, Homecoming did so well, because it brought the fun back into Spider-Man.
Right, right, for sure. But they wanted to excise as much of that as humanly possible and went so far afield with it that they had the Shocker, who they went full Ultimate Universe crazy with the Shocker.
Yeah.
Which was fine. I mean, I'm all for going all in balls to the wall comic book, you know?
Yeah.
But then the Green Goblin, they just couldn't get it there. And I don't know, I'm not sure why. They got it there with Doc Connors, too. Like, it wasn't the lizard I wanted to see. It wasn't the version of the lizard that I wanted to see. But that didn't stop them from going buck wild with a version of the lizard that fought through schools and had, you know, that was a lizard. But you can't make the Green Goblin the Green Goblin. And that bothered me.
Yeah, that was crazy. And the rhino was kind of a give up, too, the way they did the rhino. Mm-hmm. Just being in a suit. Paul Giamatti just being in a suit like that.
And a character that was just a little too comically over the top.
Mm-hmm.
It was like they that relaunch franchise across the board was just trying too hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To achieve something that wasn't necessary.
Yeah.
But
that's right.
I think, and I don't know if this is a debate, right? I think this is obviously a debate.
I'll take debate.
And there's a dark horse here, which shall remain nameless. But I think that it comes down to, is Green Goblin the Joker to Spider-Man's Batman? Is he the arch nemesis of Spider-Man?
And I think, yeah, on the surface, yes.
Yes.
And I'm party to the dark horse as well. So
we are so party to the dark horse, but
yeah. Yeah, I would say so, because I mean, if you think about it, the only person that would be close to the Goblin would probably be Doc Ock himself. It would be.
Yeah, I agree.
You know what I mean? But I'm going to go with Green Goblin, the fact that, you know, he was the reason why Mary Jane was killed, and he discovered, you know, Peter Parker's identity pretty quickly. And was able to use it for leverage. And then at the same time, early on, they played it off as in Osborn didn't know what he was doing when he was that way. So in a way, you're kind of like, it was kind of like the Wolfman. Like when the Wolfman turned into the Wolfman, he didn't know what he was doing. And then once he came, the moon went away and he went back to a normal life. He was like, oh my God, what have I done? What have
I done? Exactly. You come home, all your clothes are in shreds and you're covered in blood. And you're thinking, okay, I'm pretty sure I didn't go to the pub last night. And I think, though, that in the long run, Green Goblin is in so many ways the Spider Joker, because there is that sort of affinity.
Yeah.
It's almost like you half expect Spidey and Green Goblin to walk up to a time clock and punch in like the sheepdog and Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
Good morning, Peter. Good morning, Harry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because
they just go at it, you know, because that's their job.
Yeah, and Osborn's.
Imagine the cycle. Okay, so we know that he killed Gwen Stacy, right? He killed her. That was a major turning point, not only in Amazing Spider-Man but comics. But imagine the psychological torture of saying, "You're my son's best friend.
Yes,
I know your secret identity. You're Peter Parker.
Yes.
Guess what? I'm taking my mask off. Look at me. I'm your son's. I'm your best friend's father. Go tell him." Arrest me, demask me in public, get me sent away.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to do that if you're a 16-year-old kid and your absolute best friend's dad is your arch nemesis?
I mean, and if you think about it as the 16-year-old kid, the last thing in the world you want to do is have to deal with your sullen best friend for the next 16 years while dad languishes in prison.
Right. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Like, right.
Yeah, gee, Harry used to be a barrel of lass until that god-awful Spider-Man sent his dad up the river for crimes he actually committed, but still. Yeah.
And they copied that in Homecoming, except for this time it was his girlfriend, and it was his girlfriend's dad is the Vulture, so they kind of so like that same character.
That's true.
It's almost like sort of things you never got to see, like, you know, Norman taking Peter and Harry, like, to the amusement park. Well, I'll come by and pick your kids up at 7. And
right.
I am so going to murder you.
But that's the point, right? You had to be – you couldn't not go to the – you know, you couldn't tip your hand that you – you know, you couldn't make it really obvious. So you still had to live life as – Peter Parker, best friend of Harry Osborn, son of Green Goblin.
Yeah, it's like, you know, seeing your best friend's mom making out with some guy, and you're like, how do you deal with that?
Because all Green Goblin had to do was write an editorial to the Daily Bugle if he wanted to out him.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yep.
But he used this.
It's like, yeah, dear Daily Bugle, did you know that Manhattan's favorite superhero is just a boy?
But think about how smart it is to use that leverage.
Yes.
Like that is insidiously genius to.
And the thing about it is that speaks to the entire split personality concept. Is that's not Norman Osborn revealing Norman Osborn to Peter Parker / Spider-Man. That's
correct.
Green Goblin outing his vehicle.
Right.
Because he is just that crazy and mean and terrible, right, that he's going to force Peter into this ultimatum that, mm-hmm, you know, is a lose-lose situation for Peter himself. And, you know, he's actually using Harry as a pawn in this, Norman is much a pawn in the, yes, schemes of the Green Goblin, which makes him an even worse villain.
Jeez, that didn't even occur to me. That is...
That poor Norman is just gross, trying to make a living with
that's
his...
That's to the point where it's gross. Like,
yeah. It's like, so he's living using in your skin.
Norman and Harry and Aunt May and Gwen Stacy and Peter Parker,
yeah,
as a pawn. Not Spider-Man, but Peter Parker as a pawn. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because Spider-Man could go toe-to-toe with him. Peter Parker just has to suck it up when...
Yep.
Norman drops by to check in on Harry.
Ooh, yes. When he knocks on Aunt May's door. Oh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because you don't know. You don't know if that's Norman or Green Goblin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah.
Because you also get that point where the Green Goblin is no longer is the costume a necessity.
Right.
Yes.
I think the demasking is that point where the Green Goblin says, I don't need this shit anymore.
Right.
I am the Green Goblin. I damn sure am good and ready to. And every time you see this mug, is it him or me?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And best friends forever and ever and ever.
All right. All right. Let's wrap it up. That was. I can't think of a better way to wrap this up. That gives me creepy crawlies.
It is creepy.
That revelation gives me creepy crawlies.
And that's the strength of these arcs. I love when we do these arcs or certain things where we really start to analyze these characters, and then one or both of us is looking at them in ways we never imagined, or our guests will, like PJ did earlier, will bring things into the, and you're like, you know, damn it, that works so perfectly. If they didn't do that on purpose, they should have.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. If they didn't, you're right. If they didn't do that on purpose, they absolutely should have, because that is almost too coincidental.
Yes. Kind of like the stepson having the last name of Osborne.
Yeah.
All right, PJ the Vega Bomber. Thank you, yes, for coming on and blowing our minds once again with your
With us for this, because we had to kind of bump you like a Letterman guest. And
hey, that's all right. I just apologize that my cheap, expensive Samsung S8 phone overheated for some strange reason, and I figured out it was just because of the when you have the battery charger on it while you're doing, I guess, video, it heats up. So that's what that was.
Hey, but anytime. You're just like so hot.
That's why it was going to blow up, huh? I guess the phone was going to blow up.
It was like it couldn't handle your natural heat.
Oh, man. Yeah, anytime you guys want to geek out and talk about this stuff, yeah, I will go there with you all the time, because as you can tell, I think kind of deeply.
So what do you got going on that you need to tell people about? Are you...
Yeah.
Yeah, like, what are you recording? Yeah. What are you doing?
Yeah, so I already just dropped just a little preview video for Solo, just talking about how I'm kind of in a weird place with it right now, because I thought I'd be a lot more excited. And then, of course, next week, Black Panther drops on Blu-ray, which will give me another excuse to talk about that movie, because I absolutely loved that movie. So that's coming, and so I'll be talking about that as well, especially a lot next week.
Yeah, it's already coming out.
Where do we find all this?
All right.
Where do we find you?
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, so on YouTube, if you just punch in Vega Bomber, you'll find me on there. If you go to Facebook, there's a Facebook page for Vega Bomber as well, and I'm also on Twitter also, and Google Plus, if that's even still a thing. I'll throw that out there.
Sure. Yeah, it is, as far as we know. And also, if you get a chance, go back and look through. I presume you have a pretty good archive by now. Go find the Foskers, because
yeah,
that is just a ton of fun.
Yes, yes. And I wasn't able to do it. This was the first year that I wasn't able to do it, but we'll be back on track with that again for next year. So the Foscars or the Fanboy Oscars, I always invite special guests to come on, and they take a category, and then we tell you fanboy style what really should have been nominated versus
absolutely
what other guys say.
Yeah, I just had to give a shout out to that because I've had the good fortune of being on some Foscars episodes, and that was just a treat. It was just fun. And, of course, we're coming to you through the auspices of the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com. And we are just really thrilled to have a brand-new story arc. Next week we'll be back thinking outside the sandbox with Sandman.
Yes, baby. We're going to talk about the sometimes Avenger, sometimes hooker with the heart of gold.
That's right.
That's right. I'm just curious. Can Sandman actually kick sand in somebody's face? I'm curious.
Or is he kicking himself in someone's face?
What's Hayden Church? Is that his name from the...
Charles Hayden Church or something?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right.
Who actually on screen looked more like Sandman than Sandman.
Right.
I love the casting. I wish they could have let his character shine instead of making it a Venom fest.
Yes.
I know.
We'll talk about that next week. So be sure to watch the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com because as we speak, this just a couple of days on Sunday, on Mother's Day, for no real reason other than it just happened to be this coming Sunday, the latest episode of the Rantcore Pit. Not the Rantcore Pit Live, but the Rantcore Pit.
It's back to
the I finally got a chance to sit down and record an episode, and we're talking about Solo because we recorded it the night of the world premiere. And you can, of course, catch Eddie and myself on the first and third Sundays of every month at DallasOnAir.com for the Rantcore Pit Live. From 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Central, first and third Sundays of the month, and the first Sunday of each month, Eddie and Colleen Medina, the Cryptid Couple, bring you Figments, the Unexplained Mysteries podcast. That is from 9:30 to 10:30, preceding the Rancor Pit Live. And on the third Sundays of every month, the third Sunday of every month, I will be bringing you the latest episode of Isle of Toys. That's A-I-S-L-E. Eddie pointed out someone that said they couldn't find it because they were spelling it like Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs, only with toys. But A-I-S-L-E, like the toy store aisle or the toy aisle of a store. And, of course, the alliteration Isle of Toys. Be sure and check that out again, 9:30 to 10:30 a.m., third Sundays every month on DallasOnAir.com, right before the Rantcore Pit Live.
I tried to pitch to Eddie that they do an episode of Figments about the weird time-traveling man in black that showed up at his first panel and talked about the aquatic ape theory and that disappeared into the night and nobody knows who he was or where he went. So I'm hoping that he can do some follow-up on that. That was a great day. All right, guys. So join us next week. We're going to be talking about the silicone Sultan of Swing, that Sandman that you love, man. As always, stay away from Orville Redenbacher. I don't trust him. I think it's the hair. I think it's that Reba McEntire hair that he's
sporting. He's got like Joker hair with silver streaks sprayed in it.
Yeah, he does. I just don't trust him. So join us next week. Bye, collect. Enjoy your comics. Thanks again, PJ. You are amazing.
Absolutely, man. Anytime.
Say goodnight, gentlemen.
Goodnight, everyone.